Good afternoon, everybody. Please be seated, and we'll get ready for our next case. Again, our next case is case number 61581, Principal Investments, Inc., et al. Versus Dade Judicial District Court, and Cassandra Harrison et al., Real Parties in Interest. Mr. Pulsenberger, you're here representing the appellants. We have Mr. Jones and Ms. Buckley representing the respondents. And for the record, before we proceed, Justice Ron Perriger is recused from participating in this case. So this will be a six-justice case. And Mr. Pulsenberger, I assume you'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal in this case.
3 minutes, if I may.
You may do so. Okay, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Gibbons. May it please the court, Dan Pulsenberger for Rapid Cash. There are a number of reasons in this writ petition and the following appeal why the district court made rulings to keep these matters in front of itself when the issues presented either should be in the justice court or should be in arbitration. And I think the motivating factor for all of these rulings was the district court's disgust at what OnScene had done, the process server for the attorneys for my client. But nonetheless, that and I don't disparage the district court for that. I've said in my reply brief, any right-thinking attorney would feel the same way. But that's no reason to violate the rule of law in all of these situations. Let me start with subject matter jurisdiction, because I think that is the issue that cleanly gets rid of every issue in the writ petition. There is no reason why these claims for injunctive relief only to set aside the default judgments in the justice court to be in the district court. These plaintiffs, these borrowers, had an adequate remedy at law in the justice court, a procedural remedy. Rule 60, Rule 60B and 60C in the justice court are just the same as they are in the district court. 60B allows relief from judgment, and 60C actually provides that if service wasn't made, the judgment and the default have to be set aside. It's really as simple as that. That is their remedy here. It's not to bring a special action. And under Bonnell versus Lawrence, there would be no special action because the remedy is under Rule 60. There's no reason to have to bring a special action. The savings clause in Rule 60 that says that the rule is not meant to limit any independent action doesn't actually create the right to an independent action. And it's very narrow, as Justice Pickering's opinion in Bonnell has pointed out. It's only extremely narrow circumstances where you don't have a remedy, where you would bring any kind of independent action. And here they have that remedy. And what all of the borrowers here should do, as I've argued throughout this entire case, is move to set aside the judgment. There's no dispute. It's in my briefs. It's in their briefs. Anyone who's come in and claimed that they weren't served, we've set aside default judgments in the judgment.
Pulsenberger, is there a distinction between the issue of fraud upon the court versus setting aside the judgments?
That's a very interesting question. Rule 60B does set out fraud and fraud upon the court, and this court used to have a distinction.
That's a reason for setting it aside, not, say, an independent action as to fraud upon individuals.
Well, let me break that down a couple of ways. I think the remedy is under 60C, but they don't even have to show fraud. All they have to come in and say is we weren't served. If they weren't served, no matter what the reason, whether it was fraud, whether it was inadvertence, as long as they weren't served, that default judgment is no good.
But they make a distinction in some of the cases I've read that even if it's handled in the district court, that doesn't set aside the judgments in the justice court, but it's a fraud action for fraud upon the court as those individuals.
And that's where I think you're going, is the fact that they've got other claims that depend on the fact that there's a fraud, but they're not the subject of this class certification. The only thing that's the subject of this class certification are the claims to set aside the defaults and the default judgments. Because it seems to me that Judge Gonzalez realized that the individual issues in fraud claims, as this court has held in Lopez, the individual issues would not predominate over the common issues, and so you couldn't certify a class in a fraud claim. So, and also, they're asking for money damages.
Let's go back, because you bounced over that very quickly. This is a very unique situation in terms of that kind of fraud, and back to what you alluded to in your opening statement, as to the service which the attorneys on behalf of your client relied upon to go forward and do this. So they are part of this group that created this alleged fraud.
And that's what they raise as one of the common issues of fact and one of the common issues of law. And I say to you that they aren't even issues, because it doesn't matter whether agency applies here. It doesn't matter whether On Scene had a policy and practice of doing this. Realize On Scene is a party in the district court, but is not a party in this case. So whatever claims they have against On Scene theoretically are still ongoing. It doesn't even matter. There isn't even a question of law.
That's a nice walk away, but the action doesn't go forward without that action, which is part of the bundle, so to speak.
Mm. Well, it does, and we'll probably talk about that in the appeal.
It's the agency relationship and relying upon the party they...
We'll probably talk about that in the appeal, but in the class action, the only issue is whether to set aside the defaults and the default judgments. And I say that 60B gives them the relief no matter what. It doesn't matter if there's agency. It doesn't matter if there's a practice. It doesn't matter if there's constructive notice. If a borrower comes in and into the justice court and says, I wasn't served, and makes a 60C motion, and the district judge believes that, they set aside the default. And there's not even a common question of law, because there isn't an issue of law. I've never disputed that. If they come in and say they weren't served, if they prove they were, so far the people who've said it, we've set aside the defaults. If we actually follow the procedure and they prove they weren't served, then that's it. There's no question of law. There's no dispute on that. If they weren't served, we set aside the defect. And so that's why I don't think, first of all, I don't think this should be in the district court. It should be in the justice court. Forgive the gender bias, but there's the district court's being very paternalistic in this case, thinking that it has to control what happened in the justice court because there was some issue that took place in the court system. And clearly this is a matter, in my opinion, that should be in the justice court and only would come to the district court in the appellate procedure. But none of these issues were even raised for the first point in the justice court. So their remedy is in the justice court. They should bring Rule 60 motions. Let me go to, which is a springboard, what you and I were talking about, Justice Douglas, is the fact that there is an individual issue in this case. There's only one issue in this case. Was each defendant in the justice court served? If the defendant was served, then we don't set aside the judgment. If the defendant wasn't served, no matter what, we set aside the judgment in the justice court. So there is no common issue. There is, and I talk about Walmart versus Dukes in my brief, and talk about how the U.S. Supreme Court has made clear, even under Rule 23A commonality, that to have commonality, you have to have the ability to give class-wide relief with a single order. And here you can't do that because the issue in each case is whether that person was served. And it's the only issue involved. So we don't have any common issues. Now, we used to believe that common issues were just any question of fact or any question of law. And we see that in the Myers versus District Court case. But as I read Myers, Myers was asking for Rule 23B2 prospective injunctive relief. These people were coming in and saying, look, the landlords here are keying us out, locking us out of our abodes, enter an injunction telling them they can't do it. You don't need anything other than the issue of whether they are doing it to get prospective injunctive relief. Nowhere are they asking for prospective injunctive relief. I don't think I would seriously fight that. On-scene's going to have some problems with that issue, but I don't think On-scene's going to be involved here anymore. So they don't have the ability to give class-wide relief. So we don't have Rule 23A commonality.
So, and, Mr. Posenberg, are you going to reach, in your 5 minutes remaining, the question of the nature of this certification and whether or not it is overly inclusive?
You know, I have that down as my fourth issue. Let me get to that. Because the more I thought about it, the more I think I put it in the briefs, because we fought about it so much in the district court. But as long as I've got it in the briefs, I'll talk about it here. I think the 23A issue gets rid of everything. The commonality issue, I think the subject matter jurisdiction gets rid of everything. We don't need to get to this. But the class description is so broad that it covers not only the 460 people who claim not to have been served and didn't opt out. Now, I will tell you there will be a dispute about at least some of them from the evidence that I have seen. So just them claiming not to be served doesn't necessarily prove that. But the district court's description also included in the class anyone who didn't, the 7,000 people who received notice and didn't opt out or didn't respond in any way, and the 8,000 people for whom the notice was undeliverable. Now, it is, that is far too broad a class, because we're including in here people where there it is a question whether they even should be involved. And so I think it is too broad a class definition. I don't think it can be saved with subclasses. I think you would have to get rid of everybody except the 460 people who claim not to have been served. But even then, I get back to my commonality issue, there's an individual question. There's only one question in this case, and it's an individual question in each case, and that keeps us from certifying a class. I'd like to save my 3.5 minutes for rebuttal.
You may just
thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Jones, are you going to divide your time with Ms. Buckley, or are you going to take the whole
thing? I'll be taking the whole thing.
Okay, very well. You may proceed.
Good afternoon. Again, my name is Randall Jones. I'm here on behalf of the class. And let me start by saying this. The fundamental issue here is that we've come to this court seeking equity. And as a part of that process, it's important to remember what we're talking about. We're talking about a company that we believe, and at least at this stage of the case, Judge Gonzalez seems to agree with us, that we've got a company that participated in serving upwards of 17,000 people. And remember the people we're talking about. These are people that are the most economically vulnerable in our society. Serving them this so-called sewer service, not giving them notice of their claim, and then taking a default judgment against them, and then executing against them. So that is a fundamental point that cannot be lost in this discussion. This isn't just a nice academic discussion. This has affected real people. And so we came in equity, and that is the fundamental difference that we have with Rapid Cash in how it understands this case and what is important and what legal doctrines are involved in this case. We came in equity, and as is clear from our rules and our Constitution and your precedent, the Justice Court does not have jurisdiction over equitable claims. And I appreciate Mr. Poulsenberg's point about, well, hey, you have a remedy. You have a remedy under 60B. We also have the right, and it's ironic, in fact, in this particular setting, that Mr. Poulsenberg would say, look, you have another remedy. When it's so interesting that Mr. Poulsenberg also wants to argue about other remedies that we have with the arbitration clause, which is the subject of the appeal. They like to foist remedies on other people. We like to choose our own remedy. Our clients want to choose the remedy of equitable relief because we think it's the most appropriate relief in these circumstances. And I would like to quote, if I could, and I think we are speaking about this this saving clause issue. Fundamentally, we have to, I believe we have to start there and go from there. But I'm quoting Liebrow versus Walls, 1987 case of the state of Nevada. And it holds that when a judgment is procured by fraud and the fraud is so successful that the other party is not even aware, he has a claim or defense, it may be said that he has no reasonable opportunity to present it. That keeps one party away from the court by conduct, preventing a real trial on the merits, and is extrinsic fraud and forms a sufficient basis for equitable relief from the judgment. And that's what we're talking about here. The claims, and just to remind the court, our claims here are, we're looking at under, let me find my notes here. I don't know what I do with my notes here. Oh, I'm sorry. Declaratory relief under NRS 30.010, injunctive relief pursuant to Article 6, Section 6 of the Nevada Constitution, and also pursuant to NRS 33.010 and NRCP 65. So when you look at that, and I want to talk about Bunnell for just a moment. And by the way, I'm very familiar with Bunnell. I lost Bunnell, so I understand that case. But that case is completely distinguishable from this case, and here's why. In Bunnell was the plaintiff. She brought the claim. So she obviously knew she had a claim. She then knew she had a hearing on a summary judgment, and she failed to show up for that hearing. Then she failed to ask for reconsideration. Then she failed to appeal it. So in each instance that this court found that did not apply, that the savings clause under Rule 60B did not apply, it's because of her own conduct. Now contrast that with the situation we have here. We have upwards, we believe, of 16,000, almost 17,000 consumers who never knew they were sued, who didn't know a judgment was taken against them, didn't know they had an opportunity to appeal. The first knowledge they had of this incident, of these judgments, was when they got garnished. And again, we're talking about, and I think it's important to understand, we have a sophisticated payday loan business that has very sophisticated contracts of adhesion. And again, our most vulnerable citizens from an economic standpoint on the other side, who don't understand what their rights are. In Bunnell, you even said in Bunnell, rarely and then only under unusual circumstances, unusual and exceptional circumstances, should Rule 60B savings clause be exercised. Well, I ask this court, if this case is not one of those rare and exceptional cases, what is? When will you ever be faced with one? And what would be the point of the savings clause? If it's not to be used now, then I would submit to this court it would never be appropriate to use it. Now, with respect to jurisdiction, and again, this is important because Mr. Polsenberg wants my client, well, he wants to dictate what claims my client should bring. And as you well know, and you have certainly said over the many years, you and the other members of this court over the years, the plaintiff gets to decide which claims they bring. We have decided that it is in our client's best interest to bring equitable claims. And there is still things to be done here. This is not all retroactive or a retrospective issues we're dealing with. These are issues, prospective issues as well. For instance, we're asking for declaratory relief and injunctive relief. The injunctive relief is these judgments are not all executed on. Interest at judgment interest at what in the old days when I started practicing used to be usurious rates. Now we all know the legislature is in its wisdom has seen fit to do away with usury, but these economically vulnerable plaintiffs are still subject to these incredibly high interest rates, attorney's fees. So if we don't get an injunction, we'll set aside the judgment? Well, you know, that's an interesting issue that I'd like to talk about a little bit later, by the way, on the appeal, whether or not the arbitration clause has any validity in the position they've taken. But Mr. Polsenberg actually said, and I think it's at page 48 of our brief on the writ, our answering brief, that, and he repeated it today, they'd set aside any judgment that was not served. Well, from a standpoint of a class action, then they've essentially admitted liability from our perspective. But they haven't said they will disgorge the money they got wrongfully, including all that interest and all those attorney's fees, or that they will forego the judgment with the interest and attorney's fees that has continued to accrue over the past years. With respect to jurisdiction, Article 6, Section 6.1 vests the district court with jurisdiction over all cases excluded by law from original jurisdiction of the Justice Court. So it says, essentially, as you all know, the district court has jurisdiction over all cases that the Justice Court doesn't have jurisdiction over. And NRS 4.370 lists all matters in which the Justice Court has original jurisdiction. And 4.370 does not include any actions for equitable relief. This court has consistently held that original jurisdiction over equitable claims, such as injunctive and declarative relief, are in the within the purview of the jurisdiction of the district court. NRCP 57 also provides for declaratory relief in district court, even though other remedies may be available, as does NRS 30.030 and NRCP 65. And was held in Periscandolo versus Christensen, if I get that right. That's an old case. That goes back to 1948, Nevada case. Because the district court has original jurisdiction over equitable claims, it has supplemental jurisdiction over any remaining claims. With respect to the cases cited by Rapid Cash, they cite the KBJ case, the State versus Cop, and G.C. Wallace. Every one of those cases they cite is a case where the Justice Court had jurisdiction, unlawful detainer or misdemeanor actions. That is not the case before this court today. The Bernadetti case, the Nevada case, the court may modify a final judgment in an independent action on grounds of mistake as well as fraud. Nevada case. And I want to make sure it's clear. This case, contrary to what Rapid Cash has told you, this case is not a continuation of the Justice Court case. And it's from my perspective, it's very disingenuous to suggest that. If you think about it, this has nothing to do, our case has nothing to do with the enforcement of the contract itself. Their claim is you owe us a debt, you owe us money, you have to pay us under the contract terms. Our case is a completely different animal. It is based upon a wrongful judgment, a judgment obtained by a fraud on the court or an abuse of process. That has nothing to do with the enforcement of the agreement itself. It has to do with the conduct in which the litigation, separate from the terms of the agreement, it has nothing to do with the agreement and how they decided to serve our clients.
Mr. Jones, could you maybe talk a little bit how that your theory dovetails into commonality and the Dukes and Walmart versus Dukes analysis, that you feel it's applicable or not applicable to this case?
I would love to do that, Your Honor. In fact, and I do a little bit of Rule 23 work, and so I've been involved with those cases just about since my career started. And there is a fundamental difference between our perspective on commonality in this case and their perspective. And let me put it real simply. Mr. Polsenberg, to his credit, acknowledges at least 460-some-odd people have said, at least so far, that they were not served. The common question at issue here is, were you served or were you not? It has nothing to do with individual claims of proof. It's one question. Did you get served with a complaint, or did you not get served? And every single class member that to be a member of the class has to answer that question, yes. So let's just look at it real simply. And I think Mr. Postelberg even conceded this point at one point during his argument. At a bare minimum, and I'm just surprised in going back over these briefs that I didn't pick this up sooner myself, then clearly we have a class for 460-some-odd people without question. So we have a properly certified class as to those people at a minimum. But understand, the case law is clear. I don't care if you're in federal court, including the United States Supreme Court, or state court, and I don't care which state you're in just about any case state that follows Rule 23, you look at the basic issue, that common question, and you don't go through an extensive evidentiary hearing. Even with the more stringent rules under federal court, you still don't do that. You look and see, is there this common fundamental underlying issue? And if so, you certify the class because you can conditionally certify it. If it turns out through discovery, remember where we're at in this process. We know we have a valid class as to a substantial number of people. We certainly satisfy numerosity with 460 people. We believe it's thousands of people. But that question has been answered already in the affirmative, and numerosity has been satisfied, which goes to all other issues, which Mr. Postelberg didn't have a chance to address, such as predominance, typicality. All those conditions are met under Rule 23, at least as to a minimum number of class members, 460-odd to date. But under those circumstances, this court should certainly allow us to go forward pursue those claims. With respect to Walmart, Walmart is a fundamentally distinguishable case, and here's why. That case is a Title VII case where you have hundreds of managers around the country in hundreds of stores, and the fundamental question that has to be answered there under Title VII is, was the particular employee disfavored? Those require, as found by the Supreme Court, individual proofs. 1.5 million people, what happened to you in your particular circumstances? That's not what we're talking about in this case. In this case, were you served or not? A simple question, which is, I think, the epitome of the type of case that is appropriate under 23A. And we cite the Skies case versus Mel Harris, which is a New York District Court case from 2012, which was included, by the way, sewer service, fraudulent judgments obtained by a finance company, where the Federal District Court there said that was appropriate, and that the issue of individual proofs was not a bar to the class action. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Postelberg.
Well, listen to what he's saying. I mean, the question involved here calls for an individual answer. He says the common question here is, were you served or were you not? So the question is, were you served? 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 It doesn't call for a general question. In Walmart, Justice Scalia rejected the notion that the common question was whether Walmart managers had the ability to increase pay. He said that doesn't go to the merits of the claim.
Do you look at Walmart differently because it's a Title VII?
No. And they can distinguish that because it's, and I've set out in my reply brief and in my opening brief why all the federal courts have been applying it in all types of cases, not just employment cases. But this court in Schutte versus Beezer said that the question has to go to the merits of the claim. And the question here calls for individual issues. He even said every single. We're going to have to ask this of every single plaintiff, which is why I say even the 460 can't be a class, because it calls for separate questions. And Sykes is different. There was a common question in Sykes because the defendants admitted filing fraudulent affidavits of merit in every single case, which is a different issue under the Fair Credit Act from the issue that we're dealing with here. And they bring in Libos and talk about extrinsic fraud, and maybe that's what you were talking about, Justice Douglas. But the fact that there is fraud involved, Fraud, whether heretofore considered intrinsic or extrinsic, used to be a line that we had in 60B that went to whether the six-month time limitation applied. And that's why you had independent actions, because you were past the 6 months. I don't see where these class members, maybe aside from the four representatives, are even at the beginning of the 6 months. Because for the 6 months to run, you have to be served with notice of entry of the judgment. And counsel comes in here and wrings his hands about, and I apologize, I shouldn't have said that, and talks about equity and says, well, these people won't even know until they're garnished. Right. Their 6 months hasn't started to run, these class members.
Mr. Posenberg, he also indicated that some people had, in fact, had their wages garnished, if I heard him correctly.
And I'm quite surprised that he's saying that his claims for those.
So he had the two different groups.
It seems to be saying that those claims for damages and disgorgement have been certified and they weren't. And all the briefs, including theirs, talk about the only claims that were certified were those to set aside the default judgment. So that argument really surprises me.
Mr. Posenberg, I'm sorry. Maybe the chief will give you a moment or two longer since I'm going to ask a question. Are you going to address the claim made by the respondents that they can choose the nature of the action that they wish to bring, and in fact that the original jurisdiction for an equitable claim, which they apparently have, is only in the district court?
No, they can't. Bonnell makes clear that if they've got a procedural right to set aside the judgment in the court that entered the judgment, and even talks about you should bring that claim in front of the judge who entered the judgment.
You also reject their distinguishing analysis as it relates to Bonnell.
Yeah. We're all lawyers. We can distinguish anything, I suppose. But the reasons that they've cited to distinguish Bonnell don't make any sense in this context, because these people can move, even now, can move to set aside the judgments. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Posenberg. And thank you again for your arguments and briefs on this case. This case will stand submitted.